Welcome to Slay, the podcast where we dive into all aspects of female health and fitness. I'm your host, Louise Hazel, and in today's episode, we're going to be exploring how we women can optimize our nutrition to achieve our fitness goals. Now, it doesn't matter whether you're training for your first marathon or you're a stay-at-home mum. If you want the best information that is backed by science when it comes to your nutrition, then this episode is for you. Now today I'm being joined by an incredible woman who's revolutionizing exercise, nutrition and performance for women. She has directed research programs at Stanford and AUT University. She's the author of Raw and works closely with USA Cycling. Please welcome exercise physiologist and nutritional scientist, Dr. Stacey Sims, as we uncover how to lose fat really. Stacey, thank you so much for slaying with us. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
I'm very, very excited to have you on. We have so many fans of yours over here at the Slay Gym in Hollywood. Everyone's been like shouting your praises. We've been watching your videos on Instagram and just cheering you on from the sidelines, because I think there are so many things that we have in common in terms of like training and nutrition and wanting women in general to be better athletes. I really want to talk today about the topic of marrying our nutrition to our fitness goals, because I don't know about you, but obviously the general population, the clients that we get into Slay every single day, general population, I feel like there's this huge gap in terms of understanding with regards to what it really takes to achieve, you know, just our everyday, you know, lifestyle or fitness goals. And for majority of women that come to Slay, they're often fat loss goals. I don't like to use the term weight loss because I think it's too general. And so I would love to talk a little bit about that. But first and foremost, one of the questions and where I wanted to start was, where are 99% of the women going wrong when it comes to their nutrition? Big question.
Big question. I think relying too heavily on popular media and myths that are pervasive, especially this time of year with all like the women's magazines that are coming out going, oh, well, you ate 3 cookies. You have to run on the treadmill for 30 minutes. So there's this huge myth that it's, you know, the calories in, calories out. No one talks about the quality of food, the timing of food, what your specific goals are, because they're just, you know, there's so many things about if you want to lose weight, but they don't talk about if you do certain diets, you lose muscle mass. Who wants to lose muscle mass, right? And it's weight on the scale, but people aren't really realizing that, no, it's not fat mass, it's muscle mass. So I think there's so many things out there, but most of it is all these myths that keep perpetuating in the fitness world that people buy into and believe.
So for women, is it a question of calories in? Is it simply a question of calories in versus calories out?
From a high touch, no. Because we look at it and we see people who will delay their food intake until like noon. And so they have calorie restriction, but then they are putting on body fat. Or we see people that tend to eat a lot in the morning and then they were restricting in the evening, and then the opposite happens. They actually lose body fat. So it's not about like both of those women would be eating the same amount, but it's the timing and it's the type. And we're hearing more and more about ultra processed foods and we're on the run. And so we're not like sitting down and having a meal. There's this dysregulation of our appetite and appetite hormones. So there's so many things that are going on that it is not about calories in, calories out. And we can't actually exercise enough to burn enough calories to invoke weight loss.
So for a woman who has a weight loss goal, for example, a fat loss goal, what can you be doing in order to put yourself in the best possible conditions, put your body in the best possible condition to lose fat? One of the things that we experience quite regularly here at Slay, and it's really interesting you talk about some of these things, is when a woman is in a calorie deficit, but is losing muscle mass and increasing in fat mass. What is going on in a woman's body when that happens?
Well, a lot of it is just a feedback from the hypothalamus, from the brain, because we see like in women, we have a very sensitive area in the hypothalamus that is reading nutrition, and it's also tied into our luteinizing hormone pulse, our menstrual cycle, and our thyroid function. So if we are low carbohydrate intake and we're low calorie intake for our daily stress, as well as our exercise stress, hypothalamus is like, whoa, wait a second. We need to like really look to conserve here. And the first thing to go is lean mass, because muscle is metabolically hungry. So the body's looking at how do I conserve all of my processes, because I need the brain and the heart to work. Okay. Well, I also need fuel. Let's break down this mass. So you'll start lean mass going, fat coming on, and we'll see a higher incidence of women who are exercising a lot and they become sarcopenic because they're exercising a lot. They're not eating enough, and the body is chewing through the lean mass and putting more and more fat on.
Explain sarcopenic for those at home who just went over their head.
Oh, sorry. So sarcopenia is when we're looking at muscle quality, and we're seeing that there's more and more fat droplets and more fat intermixed within the muscle. So it's not really dense muscle fiber that we want. It becomes more of a fatty tissue. So if you think about like beef cuts that are very well marbled, that's what we think about with sarcopenia. Very well marbled, non-functional muscle.
So we're looking really for a quality of muscle that essentially comes from quality nutrition, quality training. Is that right?
Both. Yes, exactly.
So one of the things I was going to say was, so if you're in a calorie deficit, you're also in a low carb state, you're losing muscle and increasing fat mass, and you have thyroid issues. Let's say you're suffering from hypothyroidism. Are you more likely to be in that state where your body's like, no, I'm going to be utilizing breaking down your muscle mass and utilizing that for energy? And why would that be the case?
Yes, absolutely would be. And again, we look at endocrine function. And when we're talking about endocrine function, I'm not just talking about our female sex hormones and luteinizing hormone pulse. There's a direct feedback mechanism that goes from estrogen levels to appetite regulation, so leptin and ghrelin and other things that are controlling our energy processes. And when we're in a low carbohydrate state and a low energy state, and we're doing a lot of exercise, there is, again, that feedback mechanism. So everything starts to slow down. And we see that after 4 days of low energy intake or low energy availability, we see thyroid dysfunction. So thyroid starts downturning. It's thyroid, and the function of your thyroid is to keep everything humming at a higher rate. So if your body's trying to conserve, boom, thyroid goes down. And if you already are suffering from hypothyroidism, it perpetuates that. And you might find you have to change medication doses, and you're playing around with that. So it's really important that women pay attention to themselves and the fact that they need to fuel for the work at hand. And it's not about, you know, where am I delaying food intake because I'm not hungry, and how am I, you know, going to have calorie deficit? If we look at a lot of the research that's coming out, especially around fasting and delayed food intake, we're seeing that it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman, if you're fit or not, if you are delaying your food intake till around noon, having your eating window up till 7, so you're still having, you know, like 7 hour, 8 hour eating window, there are more obesogenic outcomes. So we're seeing that people are not losing weight. They're putting on more body fat. They're having endocrine dysfunction. They're having metabolic dysfunction. But for those who break a fast or start eating around 7 or 8 in the morning, and then they stop eating around 4 or 5, there isn't that dysfunction. Mm-hmm. We see that they do garner all the benefits of what people are talking about with time-restricted eating. And it has to work with your body's rhythms. Like, when do we need fuel? When we're awake and we're moving. When do we not need a lot of fuel? When we're winding down and when we're sleeping. And if we're looking also about how to lose weight, we need really good sleep. And a lot of people who are eating later at night and they are trying to get sleep, and it might have been, you know, meal within 2 hours of going to bed, then they're going to have a lot of irregular sleep patterns and really poor sleep, which then feeds forward to more metabolic dysfunction, poor blood glucose control, poor energy, fatigue, and again, kind of messaging to the brain that, hey, we're not in a healthy state. We need to conserve. And the best thing that we do is we conserve fat.
Mm-hmm. So for a person who wants to be in a calorie deficit, lose fat, if you are saying like 7 to 5 is much better than, you know, a 12-hour or even longer fasted period, what would be the best way to break fast? What types of macronutrients are we looking at? What type of fuel, what type of food should we be eating from that first meal of the day in order to make sure we're setting ourselves up for success?
We need to put a precedence on protein and carbohydrate. So if we're looking, say someone comes in and they're like, oh, I have to an exercise session or I'm going to the gym at 6 a.m. So mm-hmm. they're getting up super early and they're like, I can't eat before I go. Well, yes, you can. You can have 30 grams of carbohydrate, which is around 120 calories, if that. Mm-hmm. And that will fuel you for your cardio or your Metcon session. And then you make sure within 30 to 40 minutes of finishing that you're having your breakfast. If you're going in for more strength orientation, then you want to add another 10 to 15 grams of protein. So that may be 1 tablespoon of protein powder or a couple of tablespoons of yogurt. It's not a lot of food, but that's enough to signal to the body that there's nutrition available. We can do this work at hand. And then you have to have breakfast afterwards. And it's a good dose of protein. So we say between 35 and 40 grams. So, you know, palm and a half size serving of protein, and that can be from all sorts of different, foods. It can be nuts and seeds and yogurt, dairy, eggs. If you're leaning more towards meat, then you can do that too. But it's really making sure that you're fueling for that task at hand. And then eating at regular intervals throughout the day, making sure you have a good hit of protein and some carbohydrate at every meal. And then you stop eating 2 to 3 hours before bed.
And why do you stop eating 2 to 3 hours before bed? You mentioned this earlier. Is it because the body's like still in digestion mode and is that the type of thing that's going to disrupt sleep patterns?
Yes. So we say there's the parasympathetic system, that's the rest and digest. And if your body is busy trying to digest food, it can't get into the parasympathetic sleep pattern that you need to get into. So if you are going to bed on a relatively empty stomach, or, you know, you don't have a full meal that needs to be digested, your body can get into that parasympathetic activation, which is what we need for good sleep architecture.
And good regeneration as well, right? Rebuilding of that muscle tissue. We talked a little bit about muscle tissue and the fact that, you know, the majority of women, when it comes to weight loss, there's almost this lack of knowledge or lack of desire to want to maintain muscle mass and muscle tissue. Now, why would a woman want to maintain her muscle tissue? What's the value in that?
So many things. I don't know where to begin, but I'll start with longevity. You want to, there's a saying that we're kind of throwing around, you want to be the oldest person in the gym, not the youngest person in the nursing home. If you don't build muscle mass, you're not going to have quality of life. You're not going to be able to carry your own groceries. Your posture is going to suffer. You're going to have more metabolic dysfunction because muscle tissue really helps regulate blood glucose and so many of the other functions that we think about when we want to be metabolically healthy. When we're looking specifically at lean mass, it is something that you want to really preserve because it's not just, you know, muscle function and posture and metabolic control, but it's just the ability to withstand and be resilient to stress overall. Because if you have muscle tissue and you're strong and you have a reserve of amino acids, if you need it from muscle, it goes so far to preserving quality of life rather than just longevity.
It's really interesting you should say that. One of our clients has been recovering from breast cancer, and we've been pretty much training throughout her chemotherapy journey. And there's very little information for women about, if anything, not even a massive amount of encouragement for women to be training through, you know, chemotherapy. And I really feel like, and she certainly does feel like that has strengthened and renewed her spirit, both mentally, but also has renewed her body from a physical perspective.
Absolutely. And I was
thinking the other day about, you know, it's one thing to, and, you know, you coming from an endurance background, it's one thing to go out there and get on the treadmill and exercise, but it's another thing, isn't it, you know, cellular level. Would I be right in thinking that those two things are just extremely beneficial?
Definitely. They are so tightly tied. And the other thing about resistance training itself, besides just building muscle mass, is it creates more neural pathways. So if we're thinking about brain health and we see a sex difference in the development of dementia and Alzheimer's, we need to find ways of encouraging neural pathways. So you have Sudoku and Wordle, but also resistance training. It's so important from that central nervous system standpoint. And when we're looking at things like cancer and chemotherapy and radiotherapy, if you are well enough to be able to do training, we're not looking at building, we're looking at maintenance, and we're also looking at movement. It facilitates anti-inflammatory responses. It facilitates better metabolism. And again, as you were saying, it's a mental aspect. It really does help from the mental standpoint of being able to be stress resilient.
Now, you mentioned metabolism. The idea, I feel like every single time somebody comes in the gym and they're like, you know, struggling with fat loss, weight loss, there's this excuse that we constantly hear of, I have a slow metabolism. And I hate it because I'm just like, there are so many things that we can be doing every single day to boost our metabolism. What types of things are those, Dr. Stacey?
So number one, resistance training. Because if you're building muscle, then you're building more metabolically active tissue, which helps increase your, quote, basal metabolic rate, and high-intensity work. So if we're looking at true sprint interval training or true high-intensity interval training, both of those are a very strong stress to the body. So more carbohydrate, more glycogen, also building more muscle mass and creating an epigenetic change within the muscle so that your body isn't reliant on insulin as it usually is. So if we're looking at what is a slow metabolism, that's more of a dysfunction of your feedback mechanisms for metabolic control. So if we're looking at how do we increase our feedback mechanisms, how do we have better appetite control, how do we have better signaling from the hypothalamus that we need to build muscle and lose fat and not be so sluggish, it's stimulating it with high intensity and resistance training.
Are you saying that we should all basically train like sprinters, lift heavy, absolutely, run fast and high, yep, intensity? So, you, yes, know, I was, you know, mentioning to some of my friends earlier, whenever I take somebody into the gym, I'm always sizing them up. I'm always looking at them and the type of athlete they are, and really looking at, okay, what type of exercise is going to suit this person? Are they an endurance athlete? Do they have predominantly slow twitch muscle fibers? Are they a power athlete? And I think, you know, it still astonishes me that, you know, general population, the average woman has no idea necessarily, or may have left that kind of athletic journey behind when she left high school, when she stopped doing basketball, when she stopped taking part in sports. So it might have been a long time between that, you know, participation in sports and the connection between what she should perhaps be doing for everyday physical activity. What would you say to those athletes out there whose genetics lean more in the endurance side of things, perhaps a person like yourself?
Yeah. I'm a really good case study for that, because it's like I got into endurance as a means of being outside and escaping, like, reality, I suppose is the best way to put it, and doing adventures. And I will admit, and I say this to my husband all the time, I'm like a dog. I need to be outside every day exploring. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like the love of the endurance. But as I've gone through my entire endurance career, I've always been in the gym doing resistance training. Mm-hmm. I was like one of the few 15-year-old girls back in the day because my friend's brother was into bodybuilding and he mm-hmm. got us both in the gym. And just the feeling of being powerful, even as an endurance athlete, if you're thinking about the strength that it takes to do something that's 3 to 10 hours, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're talking about endurance versus power, I don't really see there is a huge difference in what you should be doing in the gym. Every woman should be training for power for many reasons. One, it's the strength and injury resistance, but two, women are already very highly oxidative. We have a lot of slow twitch fibers. And as we get older and we're losing more glycolytic capacity because we're having perturbance in estrogen, progesterone, we're losing more of the nerve signaling for strong muscle contraction, mm-hmm. we have to be doing power training. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we're going to default to being slow and a little bit heavier than we would like, because that's the default for the female body, to be able to go very long and slow.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about sprint intervals. Break that down for me. What does a sprint interval look like?
For the general pop or someone who's trying to get fit? When we talk about sprint interval.
Yeah, let's go general population, because I know what I'd do for sprint intervals.
Sure, we're all a little bit different. But if we're looking for general pop, when we talk about sprint interval, people always assume, you know, running sprints and like on the track. That's not what we're talking about. So sprint interval is really about a rating of perceived exertion. So we want someone to do a modality at a rating of perceived exertion of 9 to 10 on a scale of 1 to 10 for 30 seconds or less. So when we're talking about what do you mean by sprint? Yeah, it could be running. It could be on an assault bike. It could be on an erg, a rowing erg. It could be running upstairs, walking up a hill. It could be battle ropes. Mm-hmm. It can be anything that is 30 seconds full gas. And then you have between 1 and 3 minutes total recovery, because we're looking for that central nervous system and being able to go again. Because we're not looking for fuel depletion. We're looking at that fast, explosive movement and that top end to create an external stress that's going to allow our body to say, hey, okay, I need really good fast glycolytic capacity. So I'm going to upregulate some of my type 2Bs and so that I can have more glycolytic capacity. I want to be able to use ATP and CP. So that's the first bit of your muscle contraction and everything. So I'm going to store more creatine, mm-hmm. super important for women. And it also creates a neural response to having more fast twitch and the ability to conduct a nerve really quickly. And those are the things that we're after, especially as we get older. And then the big thing for general pop is we end up with more exerkines. So this is the crosstalk between skeletal muscle and more visceral or abdominal adiposity, mm-hmm. where the exerkines will signal that we don't need that visceral fat. Let's get rid of it, because it's a hindrance to the type of work that we're trying to do.
Got you. So basically, get in there, 30 seconds, up to 30 seconds of intense exercise, battle ropes, ski erg, whatever piece of equipment that you have. And then, so let's say that takes care of our cardiovascular. How many repetitions of that would you aim for in a session?
No more than 10. And most people will get to like 3 and they're like, yeah, I feel good. They do the fourth one, like, oh, I can't keep that up.
Absolutely.
And it takes time to get up to the 10. And if you can actually complete 10, then you probably haven't done it right. If you're well trained like you probably might be able to go up and be able to complete the 10 and feel like good. But most people can't do it.
I put a cap on around about 8 reps. You know, I think the interesting thing is we started a running club here in Los Angeles about 18 months ago. And it's a seasonal running club and it's a short distance running club. And the whole idea was that I think we have this, you know, I think the media perpetualizes and really really reinforces the idea that we should all be out doing low intensity exercise. And a running club should be a middle distance running club, or it should be long distance, and it should be marathons and half marathons and 5Ks. I don't subscribe to that because I know that my body is, you know, full of fast twitch and power. And so we set about, you know, creating a little sprint running group, which is really good fun. Yes, the interesting thing was that people were like, is that it? There was the question of, is that it? So there's this idea that, you know, 8 repetitions of a sprint is not a real session because it doesn't last a full hour. And when I used to say to my clients, actually, you can get a hell of a lot done and some real quality work in just 20 minutes of cardiovascular exercise. And more importantly, I don't want you to be in the gym for an hour unless we're doing, like, you know, an active recovery day. I don't want you to be doing cardiovascular work unless there's a reason behind that, unless it's an active recovery day. So, you know, having a little bit of that reiterated there is extremely exciting, obviously, for me. Now, we talked about power training. As a woman, how, I don't want to say how heavy should you go, but if we're looking at percentage of body weight, what would be a really great aim for somebody to start, you know, person who's like starting out from scratch, what would be a really good kind of place for them to be aiming to get to? Let's say for like big lifts, like squats, is there like a percentage of their body weight that they should be like, you know what, I'm going to aim for that?
I think it more comes down to form. Because like if someone has really long femurs, then they might have a more difficult time lifting, you know, 60% of their body weight as compared to someone who has a long torso. So we want to look at form and mobility and how you move through that incomplete range of motion. And then you add load. So it's like looking to add load, add load, add load so that it brings you to a failure point. So at first, you might be only able to lift and you're going 10 to 12 reps at failure. But our aim is to get you down to being able to do 3 to 4 reps to complete failure by like the fifth set. So it is very much that mobility and movement orientation first. And then you add load as you go, as long as you are maintaining really good form.
Got you.
Because I think that's one of the things that's missing in so many of those popular gym programs, and it frustrates me where, you know, I'm happy
what's
to
missing,
call them out.
The form or the progression? A bit of both sometimes.
Both.
Yeah,
both.
I would agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, it's really interesting. I think we see a lot nowadays, especially with the prevalence of social media. I feel like people are literally on social media purely to show off their skill as opposed to their strength. And so a lot of the time, often a lot of the time, the simplest exercises, the simplest moves are where a lot of our athletes here at Slay are getting the biggest bang for their buck and the biggest physical transformations. You know, we keep it very, very simple. I look at people and I'm like, okay, what's their hinge pattern like? Are they a natural deadlifter? Are they an amazing squat athlete? Like, where can we get the biggest bang for our buck? Because of course, you only typically have 60 minutes, perhaps 1 to 2 times a week with that particular athlete, always looking to kind of maximize on what we can get there. I wanted to talk a little bit about calories and calorie intake. Now, one of the things, you had a TED talk called Women Are Not Small Men. Where are we at with regards to some of the metrics that we've been using? So for example, daily calorie intake for women, what would you say the average is that we should be aiming for a person who is, let's say, mildly active?
That also depends on how tall and how old they are. So if we're looking, I always like to say, okay, the average woman who might be 5'5" and 135 or so pounds, right? If you get up and you're like, I don't feel that great, I'm just going to lie on the couch all day and watch Netflix. Just doing that, you're going to need minimum of 1800 calories.
Got you.
Just to exist on the couch, right? And we see, it frustrates me again when we see all these things about how, oh, 1100 to 1200 calories is your resting metabolic rate. No, that's way too low. We see this across the board, even in women who are heavily overweight,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they have to carry that load, they also have more muscle mass. So people are, you know, oh, well, I'm 1200 calories because I'm not that active. But yes, you still have more muscle mass. And so you are up around that higher basal metabolic rate. And then as soon as you get up and start moving, your body requires calories.
Mm-hmm.
So I have people who are, you know, training 3-4 times a week. And when they first come to see me, they're existing on 1100 to 1500 calories. So I'm like, what are you doing? You're not going to get any kind of gain. You're not going to lose body fat at all. We boost them up to 2500. So that's an extra 1000 calories. All of a sudden they're performing better. They're putting on lean mass. Their body recomp is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't believe how little they had been eating.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just recreational, you know, really busy women who are moms and career oriented and all that kind of stuff. And I'm sure you see that too. And it's just, people are just afraid to tell women to eat.
What are you using in terms of your metrics for calculating the basal metabolic rate?
Well, I'm lucky enough to have access to DEXA.
Uh-huh.
So I have people go get a DEXA so we can see lean versus fat mass and where it's distributed. If people don't have access to that, then the next thing a lot of gyms are floating around is the in-body.
Yep,
so the in-body's been validated.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, it's been validated against the DEXA.
Mm-hmm.
And I always like to see what is the lean mass. And then you can do your calculations of how much protein, how many calories, what is a resting metabolic rate look like for you? Because, you know, we are kind of in an era of personalized medicine,
mm-hmm.
and we want to make sure that our recommendations, yes, they might be generalized, but they're generalized to really go after that particular person.
Mm-hmm.
And then for people who don't have access to any of that, there are new metabolic equations that are coming out that are specific on women, because so many of the metabolic equations have, again, just based on male data and generalized. So we're seeing some that are coming out for sedentary premenopausal women, mm-hmm. for athletic premenopausal women, and then peri and postmenopausal women.
Where might we find those equations, Stacey?
I will send you the link.
Gonna say.
Because they, yeah, some of them are on the BJSM site,
mm-hmm.
and some are circulating on some of the other journal sites. So I will send you the links.
I love that. Thank you for that. The other thing I was going to ask was, what is more important? What's a more important metric that we use with regards to assessing our progress, our BMI or our body fat percentage?
A body fat percentage, for sure.
Why so?
Why? Because when we're looking at BMI, it is not representative of what is actually going on. Because you can have someone who's mesomorphic. We see this, and I fight this all the time with my military women, where they have to hit a certain BMI.
Oh.
But if you look at how fitness has changed over the years, right?
So now we're seeing they're using BMI as the marker for whether they actually make it into the military service.
And if they pass their fitness level, right? If they are hitting those BMI metrics, then they pass part of their physical examination, right? So their yearly physical, they have to do your certain tests as well, but BMI fits in there. And it's causing a massive amount of low energy availability, relative energy deficiency in sport, eating disorders, because we look at how fitness has changed and women have gotten in the gym and they are doing things like CrossFit or Olympic lifting and they're putting on more muscle mass and they still might be tiny, but from a BMI standpoint, they are perceived as being overweight or obese because they have this extra mass, right?
So it's really favoring taller athletes or taller body types, and it's actually goes against those people who are shorter, because obviously it's, you know, an equation that takes into consideration weight and height.
Right, exactly. So when we look at percent body fat, we want to see fitness level as well as percent body fat, because we also see that women who have a higher percent body fat but are still very fit having much better outcomes from a longevity standpoint than the traditional skinny model who has a relatively lower percent body fat, but very inactive and low lean mass. So the fitness level is really important, as well as the percent body fat.
So we're basically at risk of having probably one of the weakest armed forces on the planet, right? I mean, that's really, if we're looking at survival of the fittest, what you want, you know, in terms of, especially in the military, are the fittest people. But actually we're doing them a humongous disservice by purely, you know, potentially cutting out some of the best athletes based on BMI. Yeah. It's completely and utterly draconian. It really upsets me that we're still using it as this metric. But more importantly, it upsets me that we're using this metric in doctors' offices. And that we are being told that we are, that we're being told that, you know, obesity and all of, we're at risk of all of these other things based on our BMI alone. That's a humongous concern. I think there's definitely, what is it that we can be doing? Because I feel like, you know, the media obviously and the fitness industry perpetuates a lot of these myths and these inaccuracies. I feel like the reality of it is that we could have much better education just at base level to understand fuel, nutrition, basic nutrition and basic fitness. Like, I can't understand why we're in a place whereby we're still having to explain different food groups, proteins, fats, carbohydrates, and how we're still having conversations about whether garbanzo beans, chickpeas is a carb or a protein. And I'm just kind of like, you know, just banging my head against the wall on a daily basis because, you know, we're as trainers having to do a lot of that education and coming obviously hands on with general population every single day and really having to do the re-education. What do you think that, is it a curriculum? Is it education? What do you think that education could be doing to better inform women of how to look after themselves and their bodies?
Oh, my dream is to have a massive global education campaign around menstrual cycle, around menopause, around nutrition. But like being an expat, so living outside of the US, although I go to the US quite a bit for work, I walk into a grocery store. I'm like, this is a massive building filled of non-food products because their marketing and everything is just blasting really poor food choices as being healthy. And then when you're bombarded by that in the grocery store and then billboards as well, where they're putting up the companies that have all the money are the ones that are advertising. So you're not seeing farmers able to advertise, hey, eat these fruit and veg and make it really like cool. You're seeing McDonald's and you're seeing KFC and you're seeing Subway and you're just bombarded by all these messages that this is what you should be eating and this is why. And if you don't, then you should eat these alternatives that are not that healthy either. So I kind of feel like I fall into the Marion Nestle category where I'm like, we need to go back and educate people like where food comes from, what you need to be looking for, wanting to eat as close to the ground as possible, meaning least processed. And if you can do that, then everyone is set up well because we see better gut microbiome. We see from that better health outcomes and it doesn't then it doesn't weigh so much on how much you weigh when we start looking at the quality of the food and where it comes from, because that is the biggest thing that people are missing is the quality of the food. And yeah, it's so important to understand that.
What should we be filling our carts with and what are you definitely not filling your shopping cart with?
Oh, you know, it used to be you shop the perimeter of the store, but you can't even do that now. It's like, I look at putting in your grocery cart the way that you would fill up your plate. So it's primarily colorful fruit and veg and whole grains to feed your gut microbiome. And then you're accenting with really good sources of lean protein. So you can look for organic meat, chicken, you're looking for non-hormone dairy type stuff, right? If you can afford organic, yeah, but if you can't, it's not the end of the world. It's just really trying to understand that you want to not eat from a package. And even if something like I am plant-based and I see all of these new meat substitutes, and even if I was like on the transference of going from animal to plant-based, I would still question what's in that package because it's been all processed to be similar texture and taste and might be grown in a petri dish. We don't know what that does to our bodies. Mm-hmm. It's ultra processed, but yet it's marketed as this great alternative. So be able to identify it, have colorful fruit and veg, whole grains, lean protein, and then 20% is life. Mm. That's where you're getting your alcohol or your chocolate or whatever it is that can accent your full good plate.
I like life. That sounds like fun. Talking of protein, yeah. We're female. How much protein should we be consuming every single day?
Oh, I have to convert from metric because I'm really used to metric.
So, go for metric and I'll help you.
Okay. So we're looking at 1.8 to 2.3 grams per kilo per day. So that's what, around the 1 to 1.2 grams per pound?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And women are highly underproteined because we've been taught to fear eating and feeling good and feeling full, and protein does that. And we've also been taught to be very afraid of carbohydrate, but you need carbohydrate and protein together to build lean mass. So really reaching for that protein is so important. And as we get older, we need it because we become anabolically resistant to exercise and food. So we need more protein at more regular intervals.
How many portions would you be recommending a day?
The general consensus right now is if you're having three meals a day, you want to get between 35 and 45 grams of protein at each meal. And then snacks are around 15 to 20 grams. And if you're in a heavy training block, then you need to bookend your training with 10 to 15 grams of protein before and 35 to 40 after.
Fabulous. Now, my vegan clients and friends will kick me if I don't ask you about your own vegan diet and how you get that protein in. So what, obviously, you know, there's a real need and a difficulty or more of a struggle for vegan clients to consume adequate amount of protein, just pure and simply because perhaps not wanting to go down that ultra processed route can make it very, very challenging. Stacey, talk me through your own process. Like, where are you finding those, you know, forms of protein? What are your go-tos? Do you have any recommendations?
Part of it is eating more. Unfortunately, when we're looking at plant-based vegan, eating a lot of plant stuff fills you up with fiber. So you have to really learn to eat more, because if you're eating more, then you're going to get more nuts and seeds, and you're going to get sprouted grain breads. You're going to be able to eat more edamame and green peas, and you're just going to eat more volume of food with really, really good protein. For me, when I'm traveling, it's hard when you're going from border to border and crossing lines and stuff. So I travel with a combination of hemp and brown rice protein as my protein powder. If I'm in a pinch, then I'll use a whey isolate, which I don't really like to, but I will if I'm in a pinch. And I make sure that I have something available with me at all times. So I'm always looking at, okay, if it's a plant source, does it have protein in it? Yep. Okay, good. So my meals are a mix of so many different things that then do add up to 35 to 40 grams of protein. And I think people discount things like green peas are really high in protein. So is edamame and quinoa and black rice and tempeh, because tempeh is really good as a fermented product too. So there's lots of things available now. When I was 15 and went down this path for the first time, there was nothing. That was really hard. But now I'm like, oh my gosh, there's so much choice. So it seems to be hard because of the volume of the food that you need to eat. But again, women don't eat enough. So when you start increasing the volume of the food, then getting all that protein becomes relatively easy.
One of the things that I've actually seen in vegan clients who are getting the best outcomes, they're often that their nutrition is easily in excess of 2,000 calories a day for those women who are physically active and doing quality training. I've seen very little change in physiology for those people who want to stay at a lower calorie goal, because pure and simply, they're just not meeting those protein needs. They're not meeting those fuel needs. And so the body actually just kind of stays in this really, really static phase. So hearing that's going to be hopefully really instrumental. One of the things I wanted to talk about is other training modalities. So obviously we talked about the media and how and I've heard you talk about this online as well, how the fitness industry in general, fitness and health industry, is really marketing to men muscle, you know, getting bigger, and women, we should be shrinking. And therefore the types of modalities and training that we should be doing should be more docile, yoga, Pilates. What are your thoughts regarding, you know, yoga and Pilates, and where do they fit in?
So I look at yoga as being parasympathetic invoking. Mm. So even if we're doing hot yoga or power yoga or something like that, it can be a little bit of postural and endurance strength, but it doesn't count with what we're talking about with pure strength. So it does help with parasympathetic. So it's a, you know, it can be an add-on. With Pilates, it's the same with posture and balance and proprioception. So they're good complementaries, but they're not the bread and butter of what you want to do. So there's definitely a time and a place for it. But as I've said before, as women, we need to find a voice and take up space because we are always marketed as being, you need to be smaller and quieter, and you need to, you know, spend more time on the cardio, and you need to do yoga and Pilates and look this certain way. And it's just a bunch of crap.
What would you say to somebody What would you say to somebody who's doing 5 days a week of Pilates and yoga?
I'd want to know, first of all, what their end goal is. Mm-hmm. Is it because they love it and it's their soul food? Okay, I understand that. But if it is to go after a certain look or a certain movement pattern, well, we can do that with other modalities. It's the same as if you look at someone who's riding or running 5 or 6 days mm-hmm. a week. Like, okay, that's your soul food. You want to get fitter. There are other ways to get you fitter and stronger and still keep you in connected with your soul food, but we have to mix it up, because I don't like to look at it as a training block. I like to look at it as, what are we doing now so that we are still very mobile and able to do things in 5 years, mm-hmm. in 10 years. It's just added longevity. So I have so many women are like, oh, I love going to yoga and I don't like getting sweaty. It's like, okay, well, have you tried heavy resistance training? Mm-hmm. It's not going to make you bulky. It doesn't get you sweaty, but it does actually improve your strength, which will complement your yoga. Mm-hmm. So it's just trying to find that mode of what is the driver for being so wrapped up in Pilates and yoga.
Mm-hmm. Got you. I think you talked briefly online about plyometrics. Now, yeah. Plyometrics, who is it for?
Everyone.
What level, if you're like a beginner to exercise, what level of plyometrics would you advise that people, what would be a great starting place, for example?
Squat jumps. Mm-hmm. That's plyometric.
Yep.
We can do plyo push-ups off the wall.
Fab.
Right. So you're leaning in and pushing off. Battle ropes, that's plyometric.
Mm-hmm. And what are the benefits to the muscles?
So it's all about explosive movement, right? And so we're getting a really good, fast, explosive response, feeds back to the central nervous system, maintaining muscle quality. And we also see that when you're complementing strength and plyometrics, so they're working together, mm-hmm. it's better proprioception, better cognition, less injury, less illness, because there's so many adaptations that happen to that high intensity and explosiveness, and it doesn't take much. You could warm up with some box jumps, right? And so you're getting some plyometric work, and it's not overly taxing, but you're still getting that stimulus.
I do love a good box jump. I'm on a mission to match my former best. This week I'm attempting 45 inches. Please wish me luck, or send an ambulance. One of the things I might need it. One of the things, Stacey, that's been super obviously taking over. In terms of column inches, conversations here in Los Angeles, I'm not sure you'll be surprised by, is Ozempic. Now, I have my own thoughts, but I want to know what your thoughts are on Ozempic and, you know, people being prescribed diabetes medication for weight loss.
Yeah, so Ozempic, I get a lot of questions about it, because it really stimulates a particular molecule from the gut that then feeds forward to being full and also slows down the rate of digestion. Mm-hmm. So again, you feel fuller for a longer period of time. When we look at the high use of it in people who are not diabetic and are looking for it for weight loss, I get very frustrated because if you do a high protein diet, you get the same thing. Mm-hmm. And that's without exercise. Because if we're looking at a higher protein diet, and so that's up to that 2.3 grams per kilo. Mm-hmm. So that's still considered high protein.
Yep.
You get the GLP-1 release. It is very satiating. It increases lean mass, regardless if you do exercise or not, and promotes fat loss. Mm-hmm. But it's not an injection. It's not a pill. It's not an easy thing to do. Mm-hmm. And so I get very frustrated when all of a sudden there's another pharmaceutical coming out, because we're already Wally-like, if you remember that movie, mm-hmm. Wally from the 90s. And it's just perpetuating the fact that people don't like to be uncomfortable. Mm. So I get very frustrated with
it. So why do you think, why are we seeing so much promotion of drugs like Ozempic, which obviously have, you know, other side effects? You know, lots of people that I've met have experiencing hair loss, that are taking them, hair loss, vomiting, nausea, diarrhea. Even on the side effects label, there is, you know, the risk of thyroid tumors as well.
Death.
Why are we risking all of those things? Why are we promoting these drugs over the promotion of a high protein diet?
Because pharmaceutical marketing and making money, but it's also easy. It's an easy fix. Here, you just do this and you're going to get what you want. Because we're now in a society where people want instant gratification. And the idea of planning a high protein diet and trying to figure out what that means and how it works for them and maybe be uncomfortable because you're too full, it gets put in the too hard basket because there isn't education around it. Back in my early 20s, I worked for an obesity surgeon when I first finished my master's degree. So these are people who are at their wits' end. They've tried everything. They've gone through all the diet plans. They've worked with psychologists, and they're at their very wits' end to go in for a gastric bypass and a Roux-en-Y. And there were some people that were still too heavy for the surgeon to do surgery without the high risk of death. So we put them on a high protein diet. And they still had complex carbs for gut microbiome, and they lost weight. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time they ever had the education around it and lost weight. And then some were having such success on it, they decided not to do surgery. So, you know, and this is in the last ditch effort kind of obese population. Mm-hmm. So if it can work for these people, then the general population who is struggling, we have to really look and reassess what are the messages that we're putting out, and why is it that a pharmaceutical company can come in, be like, well, yeah, we designed this for people who are metabolically at an issue where they have to have medication to help them live. But yet we can give it to these people who are struggling with their fat loss, and we'll give it to them and we'll see fat loss. Like, to me, I just get so frustrated with this mass messaging of, here is this easy fix and this is the only fix, instead of reevaluating what it means to be human and how we can actually do things and help ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I think my concern is going to be the long-term effects of these drugs over time, and perhaps, you know, yes, the prevalence of the things that we're not necessarily banking on. What are the things, what are the costs associated, the real costs associated with these quick fixes? I was doing my research on Ozempic, and, you know, we were, you know, looking into the question, are they safe? And I just think the answer, simply, they say even on their own website, is we don't know, because we haven't tested it on humans.
Right.
You know, we've in tests on rodents, you know, they developed thyroid tumors, but we don't know on humans. And so, you know, I flagged up the fact, well, then this is the clinical test. You know, we will know soon enough, because
population wide. Yep.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, one of the side effects is when people stop it, they gain weight back because their appetite comes back, and the dysregulation of appetite hormones is there. So they've lost that ability to know what it means to be fed and full versus just eating.
So
because the Ozempic does have an effect on appetite regulation. Mm-hmm. And so when that is taken away, the body is all confused and there isn't that feedback and that ability to regulate anymore. Mm-hmm.
And obviously the effects, therefore, you know, they're then going to be dealing with the effects on the metabolism when where it's currently at, having had been on an extremely low calorie intake. So many problems, yes. Many problems there. What would you say if your best friend came up to you and says, Stacey, I've just received she wanted to lose 10, 15 pounds and she just really received her first kind of like set of injections. What would you say to her?
Oh gosh, I'd look at her and be like, what the, who are you talking to here? So I would really question the motivation, right? A lot of women are doing it not for the health aspect of losing weight per se, but the aesthetic aspect of losing mm-hmm. weight. And I'm talking in general here. I know there are a lot of women who are losing weight for health, and that's great. But if it's more the aesthetic, when we're looking at the weight loss that's coming from it as well, again, it's lean mass. Mm-hmm. And that's another worry yep. across the board. It's like it's weight loss, but it's not the kind of weight you want to lose.
You're losing lean muscle mass.
Yeah. And people don't put in the hard work with it. It's the same as menopause hormone therapy. They think it's a golden egg, but it's not. You have to put in the hard work from changes in nutrition and exercise to reap the benefits of the medication. Mm. And people don't do that with anything. Mm.
Stacey, I would love to pick back up on that conversation with you regarding menopause. I think it's a humongous topic that our audience would absolutely love to deep dive on. And similarly, menstruation as well. The last thing I want to start talking about, just really briefly before we wrap, is wearable tech. And
yes,
wearable technology, we are seeing it's obviously flooded the markets. People are going to be rushing out to buy all the gadgets and gizmos this Christmas. No doubt they've probably already purchased them in the Black Friday sales. When it comes to wearable technology, who's it good for?
Men.
Why is that?
I say that kind of jokingly. Because we have femtech, right? And we're seeing this upsurgence of femtech. But the technology that's in femtech is all geared around women's health issues mm-hmm. of fertility, mm-hmm. ovulation, PCOS. It's not looking at the athletic woman. Mm-hmm. When we look at the algorithms that are based on, like I have it, you know, if we're yep. looking at the Aura, the Whoop, the Garmin, all of those algorithms are based on male physiology. Mm-hmm. And when we look at the different hormone profiles of women, we see that when you have an upsurge of progesterone, you have an increase in your respiratory rate, an increase in your resting heart rate, a decrease in your heart rate variability, which then feeds forward to not being recovered or being highly stressed when it's not true, and the fact that it's just an autonomic nervous system change. Mm-hmm. And so the algorithms are not set to read these perturbations in women's bodies. And the feedback that I find from so many of these wearables has a negative connotation. Mm-hmm. And women are not empowered enough to really understand that when it says, oh, you need to recover or don't do this, that's not true for their body. And then to listen to that negative language plays on their mind. So I tell people, if you're going to buy into the wearables, you're using it like a coach uses a whistle and a clipboard. It's a tool for tracking trends. It's not a tool for an absolute say of what is happening today.
You don't have to go as fast. You can go faster or slower than the whistle, depending on how you feel.
Exactly.
That is awesome advice. I always tell my clients, and I have the same thing whenever I'm wearing my Whoop, and it's like, oh, your strain levels should be 12. And I'm like, well, no, you know, that's not what's on my program today. So I think there's this kind of sentiment that I should be hitting this goal because this is telling me I'm super well recovered or I'm not recovered and therefore I should feel tired. I never necessarily use my tracking as a determination of how I feel. I use my internal tracker for that. The other thing I wanted to say was, therefore, can we rely on these trackable devices, our wearable technology, for accurate metrics regarding calories burned?
No.
Why not?
Absolutely not. And that holds true for men and women, because when we're looking at the algorithms and how they are assessing, they missed the mark. There's about a 20% variability in the calorie count in the wearables. I had some colleagues at Stanford who did a deep dive into all the algorithms and put people through the paces in the lab to actually measure calorie output and everything that's in there. And that's where they're like, you know, it ranges from 10% to 50% variability wow. in all of these wearables.
And is that typically, so it overestimates or underestimates?
It depended on the wearable. Got you. But for the most part, it's an overestimation.
Got you. So therefore, my question is, what wearable are you definitely not buying this Christmas?
I'm not going to buy any of them. I had a question the other day. How do you track? Because, you know, I advise tech companies and I pretty much tell them what's going wrong. I don't tell them, hey, this is really good. I tell them exactly what's going wrong. But I'm very much the old fashioned person where I listen and assess, how do I feel? What do I feel like I can do today? Mm-hmm. So if I have a really hard session on my training plan and I can't do it, I'm like, okay, I'm rearranging because I know that I'm not going to hit the metrics I need to for adaptation. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm not buying any of
them. Are you wearing two wearables at the moment? I can see we've got the Whoop strap and then the watch.
I have an old fashioned watch.
Wow.
I'm an old-fashioned watch. It's even on analog.
Excellent.
Analog and in 24-hour time. The little
you mean it doesn't
and then the other one,
send your emails? And the other one's your Whoop strap.
I don't have it. Yeah, I don't have my watch connected to anything. It is a smart
watch. That's a great
idea. But I just use it for time and GPS.
Is that a Garmin? Yeah. I knew you'd have a Garmin. I know.
You want to know why, though?
Absolutely.
Because this is the... This is the only one that I can go diving and sea swimming, and it still is robust enough not to die on
yeah.
me. If I can find another brand, then I would. But so far, this is the only one I found that withstands all my water.
Thinking they go to like 200 meters or 20 meters or something like that. Mm-hmm. Decent amount of depth. Not 200. I don't even know, but I remember it being good. Stacey, yeah. I just want to say a massive thank you for joining us on Slay. We're going to wrap there as I have adult ADHD and can't listen to podcasts longer than an hour. But
I'm right there with you. I'm
definitely getting you back on. Would love to talk about menstrual cycles and training. Would love to talk about menopause. I know our women are going to come up with a ton more questions for you. I want to say a massive thank you for coming on. We really absolutely love what you're doing. Keep doing it. Keep giving it to them. Keep advocating for us. We need more women like you. That concludes this episode of Slay. Make sure you get a copy of Dr. Stacey's book, Raw. She's got a new edition dropping this January, and we cannot wait to have her back on the show. Stay tuned for more empowering discussions on female health and fitness. You can follow me at Louise Hazel, and you can follow Dr. Stacey at Dr. Stacey Sims on social media. Check out the Slay brand as well at Slay Athletic. And don't forget to subscribe to the Slay podcast and leave a review if you haven't done so already on Spotify. You can get all of the tools that we talked about in today's episode on the Slay app. Download it now for free from the App Store and join our online community.